Welcome to the South Devon area of outstanding natural beauties, Stoke Fleming to Streetwalk, with a trade and settlement theme. This is part of a series of trails developed in both South and North Devon AONBs. This podcast provides the points of interest information for the route and should be listened to whilst using the walk's printed sheets, which contain directions, information about local facilities and refreshments, and a map. This is a 4.5 mile circular route, starting and finishing in Stoke Fleming. It's been classed as a moderate walk, with two steep ascents and descents. This is a great walk with a route that includes ancient green lanes, the southwest coastal path, and stunning views. It reveals the action-packed history that lies beneath this beautiful and peaceful countryside. On the accompanying map, there are red numbered squares that show you the locations along the route at which you will need to pause to listen to the relevant point of interest clips.
During this audio guide, you'll hear the voices of long-time local residents Pam Wells of Street and Henry and Doreen Yabsley of Stoke Fleming as they recall places, people and events through the years.
From the parking area, turn right and walk down the hill to the junction opposite the pub.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. Standing here, you're close to the centre of Stoke Fleming's old-time smuggling operations. Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, illicit cargoes were stored both in the cellars of the Green Dragon pub and the tower of the church across the way. These goods would have been landed at Leonard's Cove, a notorious hotbed of smuggling down at the bottom of the cliffs below the village. From there, the brandy, silks, tobacco and other commodities were transported up the cliffs through two tunnels, one of which led right into the cellar of the Green Dragon. It is said that a light used to be shone from the tower of the Stoke Fleming Church by accomplices to inform the smugglers in boats offshore that it was safe to land their contraband. The illegal smuggling trade was a risky business. The free traders, as they were known, would be engaged in a nightly battle to outwit the government's revenue men. Smuggling was an important part of the rural economy in those harder times, and almost every coastal dweller was involved in the trade in some way. This made it difficult for the law enforcers to catch offenders, and even more difficult to secure a conviction. Most juries were full of locals involved with or sympathetic to the smugglers, and this was true even of some magistrates.
When we were children, we used to go out the old road opposite the Green Dragon. We'd go in a gate there, and the farmer's son, four or five of us, and lift up a stone, and that's supposed to be what we call it, Peter Catches Hole. Mm-hmm. That's what we throw a stone in, the littler stones, let the thing down, and run like Billy. But there could be a connection there. The things were sent down that hole because it's got to go under the road, because there was always a Blackpool Road.
From here, turn right through the iron gates into the churchyard and the church itself to play clip 2.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. The parish church of St Peter was originally built by the Normans, and it's thought that the Green Dragon pub probably began life as accommodation for these Norman craftsmen. Centuries of rebuilding and restoration have changed the church's character a good deal, but the original Norman font of red sandstone carved over 800 years ago still stands here. The church contains the second oldest brass in Devon, a 14th century representation of one John Corfe, with a woman thought to be his daughter. The pulpit was carved by another young woman 500 years later. Miss Violet Pinwell was the daughter of a Southams vicar and produced the delicate and detailed wooden carving when she was only 17 years old.
I faintly can remember being leading the horses down to be reshod. Because we've got a cousin of ours that's got photographs of the last coach that came through and changing horses.
That's right, that's where they did it in that yard there. As you were in the centre of the
village. All the way to London, like.
When you're ready, retrace your steps to the church gates and turn sharp left down the narrow lane with the church on your left. Continue to the end of the lane and at the T-junction cross the road with care to the pavement on the other side.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. From here you have a wonderful view to Blackpool Sands below and right around the long handsome sweep of Start Bay to Start Point and its famous lighthouse. Above the bay at Blackpool stands the village of Street. Despite the importance of the sea for food and income, villages like Street and Stoke Fleming were established slightly inland, in days when the seas brought the threat of pirates, raiders and invaders, living up on the hill offered a little more peace of mind. Further along the bay, beyond the long shingle ridge of Slapton Sands, which we will say more about later, you can just make out the villages of Torcross and Bee Sands lying right down on the shore. These settlements were once no more than fishermen's stores. Locals only began to dare make their homes there in the 16th century. Even then, the early settlers of Torcross and Bee Sands must have been brave or desperate or both. Corsair pirates were still terrorising the Devon coast into the 1700s, plundering communities and seizing inhabitants to be sold into slavery in North Africa. It wasn't until late into the 18th century that growing British sea power brought a sense of peace to Devon's shores.
Now, follow the pavement down the hill to your right. Follow the left fork a little way down the hill onto the coast path, which runs parallel to the road, and continue down the path to the beach.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. The sands at Blackpool conceal an ancient forest buried beneath. The stumps of long dead trees are very occasionally exposed when great storms scour out the beach. Old Spanish, French and English coins have also been found in the sand here, dating as far back as the 14th century. In 1471, the Earl of Warwick landed here following an exile in France. He was a powerful baron known as the Kingmaker, who was heavily involved in the Wars of the Roses. It's thought that some of the coins found here may have been spilt from the treasure chests unloaded from his ships.
When you've finished on the beach, retrace your steps back up the path. 20 metres beyond the toilets, turn left onto the coast path, which is signposted for Street. At the road, cross with care, and follow the coast path finger post through the gate on the left. Cross the lane and continue up the steps. Following the yellow waymarker arrows, bear right up the steep hill to the stile.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. As you reach the stile at the top of your climb, turn and look back down the hill. You have a fine view of the stream which cuts its way down to the sea at this end of the beach. This modest brook once saw a major battle. In 1404, a marauding fleet of 300 Breton ships landed round the corner at Slapton. 2,000 troops disembarked and were making their way along the coast, intending a surprise attack on Dartmouth. A hastily assembled peasant army of local men and women gathered on the far side of the stream to face the Bretons. They had been hard at work damming the stream to retain the tidal seawater and create a broad creek. The Breton crossbowmen were lagging well behind, but the impetuous and arrogant Breton commanders decided to attack without their backup. In their heavy armour, they and their knights floundered in the muddy waters, and were at the mercy of the arrows, swords and slingshot of the Devon defenders. One of the Breton commanders was mortally wounded, many knights were slain, and the English force claimed an unlikely victory, When the news reached London, Henry IV ordered a special hymn of praise and thanksgiving to be sung in Westminster Abbey.
From here, cross over the stile and turn left up the Green Lane. After 100 metres, turn left following the coast path finger post and then immediately right over a stile. Cross the field to the bottom corner and then follow waymarker arrows to the right and go over another stile.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. The cliffs along this stretch of coast are formed from Dartmouth slate. Streams and rivers have only been able to carve out fairly narrow clefts in this hard and durable rock. That is why you face the steep descent ahead down into Landcombe Valley and the climb up the other side. This link in the coast path was completed fairly recently, and a lot of thought went into trying to find an easy way to cross the valley. The conclusion was that there isn't one, but most people find that it isn't quite as hard going as it looks.
The single decker coming up from Blackpool used to go so slow that one of the boys who used to live at Tor Cross, he was a big, tall lad, when the bus conductress was on, because they used to aggravate the girl, something terrible, if she got a bit cross with them, as the bus was driving, going up the hill from Blackpool, he'd jump off, pick some flowers, and then jump back on and give her the flowers. So it shows how fast the bus is going up Blackpool Hill.
Cross the road and drop down the field ahead. Bear slightly to the right to the small footbridge across the stream at the bottom. Then head straight up the other side to a waymarker post.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. If you turn here and take a look back along the coast you've walked along, you will see a tower on the horizon, standing on the hill overlooking the sea. This is the Daymark, built in 1864 as a navigational aid for shipping. The hollow tower stands above the Dart estuary and the port of Dartmouth. Commerce across the sea was important for the town and the area. Dartmouth's wealth grew on this international trade, particularly in wine and later fish from the Grand Banks of America's eastern seaboard. The town and settlements along the river also became a centre for the building and servicing of ships.
One farm that farmed these fields out here used to do everything with horses. And I'm talking of, I suppose Tom and them were working horses in 1950, probably. He had a small tractor as well, but he still worked horses there. I mean, they used to grow corn out there years ago. Out there, you couldn't wish for better views, could you?
From here, follow the yellow waymarkers along the clifftop fields before following the path as it bears right or inland to cross a footbridge. Follow the concrete track up to the right. At the top, turn left and follow the path, then the road into Street Village.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. Street may take its name from the straight road running to Tor Cross. Originally, its spelling was S-T-R-E-E-T, as in a town street, but this was changed in 1870 to prevent postal confusion with the town of the same name in Somerset. In 1857, the village boasted two butchers, two shoemakers, a tailor, two shopkeepers, and two pubs. And within a few years, a baker and two builders had been added to the roll, along with masons and carpenters. This self-sufficient community was a far cry from the town and supermarket-orientated world of today. Despite all these trades, the mainstay of the area's economy was always farming, with the sea a close second. Generations of fisher farmers worked these fields and walked the old green lanes down to the sea to haul on fishing nets and crab pots down in the bay.
There were three farms there, and all those farms used to have dairy cows. They were South Devon's, but I'm talking now back in the 40s. There was one right in the centre of the village, right opposite the post office. There was, and as you turn to go up to Church Hill, what is the Laughing Monk now used to be the old school. On the opposite side of the Laughing Monk, there was another farm, and the lower corner of that lane that turns to the right there, below the Laughing Monk, there was another farm. There was two shops in the village. Both of them had petrol pumps. Both of them were bakers. There was also a post office in the village, separate from the shops. Both shops used to do taxi service. There was the pub. There was the blacksmith shop, which, I mean, I remember seeing horses going in to be shod and carts and that being in there for repairs. And then there was the shoemaker. There used to be a carpenter's workshop down there. There was some sheds and that on the right-hand side. And that used to be Edgecombe's builder's yard.
Now, turn right up Totnes Road opposite the village shop and post office. Pause when you get to the church.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. Before 1836, street worshippers had to attend church in neighbouring villages. Once the Church of St Michael was built, they prayed there, but villagers still could not be persuaded to be buried in the new churchyard. They preferred to be interred close to other family members in nearby cemeteries. Eventually, a free headstone had to be offered to the first person to agree to be buried here, and that inducement finally did the trick. During World War II, the entire population of Street and the surrounding areas were evacuated. The area became home to thousands of US troops and was used for massive practice exercises before the D-Day landings in 1944. There is more information and a memorial to both the locals and the troops who lost their lives in Operation Tiger in car parks along Slapton Sands. To maintain secrecy, the evacuees were not told why they had to uproot themselves. The wrench, especially for older people who had lived their whole lives here, must have been terrible. At very short notice, farmers not only had to find places for themselves and their families to stay, but also their livestock. The local people were allowed to return after the Normandy landings, although many did not come back.
Farmer Trant, that was in the right-hand farm going up Churchill there, his wife died about 2 days before they were leaving. And that was on top of having to move all their animals and everything else. Oh, yeah. They just had to move. That was it. They gave us 6 weeks to find somewhere to move to. We were lucky. We only moved down to Beeson, got a cousin down there with a farm. Aunt Bet let us go in there and have a couple of rooms in the house down there, like. But a lot of people weren't so lucky as us. They just had to find somewhere to go. My father was a builder. He was in the Royal Observer Corps. During the time the Americans were training, he was out at Start Point then, because he saw a lot of what was going on and on Slapton Nine. They could see right up the line. They could see everything that was going on. There was one time when he was out there, and one day they just saw loads and loads of ambulances going along the line. And that was when they had a tragedy there of soldiers being killed, injured and all the rest of it. Mm. So, I mean, they were getting killed and injured there all the time. When I was the last kid in Street, there was some American soldiers taking photographs. They said, we want to make a film to send back to America to show them what you're doing for us. So they had me walking in houses, you know, pretending it was my house and walking up the road and things like that. After the evacuation, when we came back, there was only 4 or 5 of us there. There's a couple of houses in Street that have got 2 lots of stairs in them. And we used to have the time of our life in these houses, running up and down one lot of stairs, hiding from each other. The houses were still empty.
From the church, continue up the hill, then turn right after 100 metres or so along a green lane with a public bridleway sign. Now follow the printed directions from point 9 through to point 13, before pausing, before reaching the thatched cottages.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. The road here was the scene of the last recorded hold-up in England, a four-in-hand stagecoach passing through Blackpool in the 1870s was carrying thousands of pounds in silver coin. Beneath the trees which shelter this valley, the coach was confronted by a highwayman. The attempted robbery, though, ended in failure. In Saxon times, Blackpool was a small estate of 11 carucates, or ploughlands. In 1086, at the time the Domesday Book was compiled, the estate belonged to one Eluard, and was recorded as having five villeins and one serf. Villeins were defined as free men, but by the standards of today they were really anything but. They, their land, and their possessions all belonged to their lord. They had a daunting list of obligations to their master, including working on his land several days a week. The poor serf, meanwhile, was the lowest of the feudal low, a slave in all but name.
From here, follow the narrow lane inland, pausing just before the width restriction sign on the road.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. On this peaceful lane, you can hear and see the stream splashing down the valley. This bright, fast-flowing little brook powered four mills in the valley, grinding the grain grown by local farmers. Back in feudal times, farmers were obliged to have their grain ground at the estate's own mill and pay for the service. The lowest of these, Blackpool Mill, is just a little further up the lane.
Our route takes us up the bridleway to the right here. If you'd like a closer look at the mill, which is not open to the public, go straight on for 200 metres. You will be able to see the mill across the stream to the left. Now, retrace your steps from the mill and turn left up the public bridleway.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. This peaceful byway is a classic example of a Devon Green Lane. These ancient routes, threaded through the South Devon countryside, were used by farmers, workers, traders, drovers, and smugglers alike. This lovely old trackway is called Mill Lane. Cartloads of grain must once have negotiated the tricky steep incline at the bottom of the lane on the way to or from the mill in the valley. Many of South Devon's green lanes were forgotten over the years and fell into neglect, becoming eroded and overgrown. A local initiative used donations from a voluntary visitor payback scheme to restore some of the area's green lanes. Through this project, called On the Right Tracks, Mill Lane has had a facelift, with eroded gullies filled in, drainage installed, and a durable surface laid down. A further initiative called Life into Landscape later carried on this good work, and between them the two projects have breathed new life into well over 50 green lanes in the South Hams.
From here, simply follow the lane along to its end.
Pause now, then press play once you reach the next point marked on the map. Stoke Fleming was originally a stoke or stock, meaning a farm or enclosure for a manor. In the late 12th century, it came into the ownership of the powerful Le Fleming family. The settlement was in Fleming hands for only 50 years, but that was long enough for them to give their name to the village. Stoke was once a Saxon manor, and a large one too, held by a chief called Ansgar. Unfortunately for Ansgar, the concrete Normans seized it after 1066, and a knight called Ludo moved in, having been granted Stoke as reward for his loyalty and valour during the Norman conquest.
Yes, we had 8 or 9 shops all at once, all, you know, making a living. And all the farms around in the area, the Bowden Estate, there was 9 farms, little farms. They all seemed to make a living.
From the post office up towards the church, there was a cobbler's, there was a hairdresser's. The hairdresser's then turned into a little clothes shop, and then after that it was converted into a house. Halfway up, there was a baker's shop. They were the ones that were bombed, and it was all rebuilt again. And there were four cottages in the centre of the village, all joined up, you know. And the end one was knocked down to make the road wider as they went round. That was about 1955, because there used to be a policeman down there at certain busy times of the year, because it was so congested. And also, there were several shops on the left-hand side as you go towards street. And, of course, they disappeared because they were taken up with the road widening. And the shops on the left-hand side, they were very dark, and you had to go down off the road level to get into the shop. Before they widened the road on the way to the school, there was a little shop in the middle of the road so that you could go either side. I don't know that you could... Perhaps you could drive a horse and cart one side, but there was this little shop standing singly in the middle. It was originally a butcher's, but when I knew it, I used to take the children up there and for their sweets.
So now the parking area and the end of the walk are just in front of you, down the road on the right. We hope you've enjoyed the route and this podcast. Please try other South Devon walks in the series, downloadable from South Devon AONB website. Or if you're in the north of the county, check out North Devon AONB's website for themed trails in that area. Web addresses are on the walk's printed pages. South Devon AONB also has an extensive list of other downloadable walking trails, which we hope you will enjoy too.